health is wealth, and this is where we're going to talk about it. The Small Conversations for a Better World podcast with hosts Jillian McCormick and Susanna Steers. This podcast represents the opinions of the hosts and or their guests to the show. The content is for informational purposes only and should not be taken as medical advice nor established legal standard of care. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Small Conversations for a Better World podcast. I'm Susanna Steers.
And I'm Jillian McCormick. Today on the pod, we're going to talk about the health of preterm infants and a groundbreaking treatment protocol that has no side effects and only improves medium and long-term health outcomes for these extremely vulnerable wee humans. To start us off, and before I introduce our guests, I'd like you to take a moment to consider the situation for a preterm baby. Imagine first the womb. It's always the same temperature. There are no sharp edges. There are no periods of stillness as around you moves your mother. Even when she is still for sleep, her biological systems are working, moving, pumping, circulating around you. It is never silent. It's not often very loud. You are never hungry. I get an image that feels kind of cozy and undeniably safe. Now shift the image in your mind to the NICU or the neonatal intensive care unit. It's cold out here, and you're often lying in an incubator by yourself, which is in almost total stillness. The sounds have changed and are punctuated with beeps and clangs and scrapes as the machines that are monitoring you and keeping you alive do their jobs for the adult humans that work for your care. You are poked with sharp implements an unbelievable number of times per day. You have never known pain like this. You cannot see well. You cannot hear well, and absolutely nothing seems right. And as you picture these vastly different scenarios, has your heart begun to race? Can you feel the tension in your body as you imagine this reality? Because I can really feel it in mine. It turns out that stress and pain in the neonatal infant are suggested to significantly contribute to the negative health outcomes that these tiny folks often contend with. Things like hearing and vision loss, movement dysfunctions, learning disabilities, behavioral challenges. Whew, it's a long list. It stands to reason that reducing the stress and pain of the neonatal time is paramount to success in these vulnerable patients. And while this is known, there are no drug interventions without side effects on the market that can help in its regard. Except maybe there is. It also turns out that there's a method of caring for a preterm infant that can do all of these things that came not from the scientific labs and medical advances of the developed world, but instead comes to us from a place in the world that literally did not have the scientifically advanced isolette to offer its preterm infants. It's called kangaroo care, and here to talk about it are two of the key individuals involved in the kangaroo care project here in British Columbia, Sarah Coots and Alex Waldring.
Sarah Coots is a neonatal nurse and lactation consultant who presently has a role at Perinatal Services BC with the Kangaroo Care Research and Implementation Project team. With her is Alex Waldring, project coordinator of the Kangaroo Care Program at Perinatal Services. Welcome to both of you, and thanks for taking the time to come and join us on the podcast.
Thank you to you both for having us.
We have a lot to talk about, but let's get to know you a bit first. Sarah, you are a neonatal nurse with some international training and experiences. Tell us about when and where you took your training and when did you become aware of kangaroo care?
So I'm a trained neonatal nurse. So in BC, you do a specialty program, which I did through BCIT. Mm-hmm. And had my first position, I guess, as a neonatal nurse at BC Women's Hospital. And certainly at that time, I guess that was a good 12 years ago, skin-to-skin care, which we kind of knew as, it wasn't kangaroo care known as, it was more skin-to-skin. Mm-hmm. And it was practiced certainly in the NICU, you know, families were invited to hold their babies, but it was much more of a a practice that happened intermittently for, you know, 1 hour a day, and not as often as we now know is helpful for babies. So a lot of my training started at BC Women's, and certainly personally I became more aware of the practice of kangaroo care, just with my own personal interest in global health and learning about it, and doing my own reading and learning about it in low and middle income countries.
Right. Well, you did a master's degree in public health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, if I'm not mistaken. And your final paper was improving practice guidelines for kangaroo mother care. You were already hooked, right?
Yeah, I mean, it all comes off the back of, you know, I had gone to Africa to volunteer for 6 or 8 months, and then had made the decision to move to London to continue my work as a NICU nurse in London, actually at St. Thomas's. And that point, that's when I sort of, everything kind of, I guess, you know, had the perfect storm and kind of came together. My experience certainly in Africa, seeing, you know, mothers holding babies in wraps on their backs, and it really inspired me. And knowing that, you know, holding a baby is more of a life-saving intervention in those settings. And then certainly coming to London, you know, the NICU care is obviously very similar in that high-tech situation, but I learned a lot in London. They had a really great developmental care program, and I found that parents were really much more involved than I had previously experienced, and parents held their babies for long times there. So yeah, that I was hooked, certainly inspired, and certainly at LSHTM, they have a whole, you know, they have experts and tons of researchers who work with maternal and newborn health in those countries. So certainly inspired me even more.
So what is kangaroo care?
So kangaroo care, or, you know, the origin sort of come from kangaroo mother care is sort of how it really first started. And so in the 1970s, in Colombia, actually, so in Bogota, Colombia, there was a pediatrician called Edgar Ray, who was, you know, head of a nursery, and there they had high rates of mortality, you know, high rates of infection. They often had, you know, old incubators that were donated, and two or three babies would be in one incubator, for example. And so there he started really and truly getting inspired by marsupial caregiving. So that idea that, a kangaroo does, you know, birth their little roux, I guess, and keeps it in their, you know, pouch at a very young age. And that's where the baby, you know, comes out, but feeds, stays warm. So anyway, had that idea that why can't we use mothers as the incubator to, you know, provide warmth, love, and breast milk to these babies that were otherwise dying in incubators. So that's sort of the beginning of the story, using mums as incubators. And there they saw, you know, a huge decrease in mortality and infections. And it's sort of morphed into really three important components that I've just kind of laid out. But so it's kangaroo position, which is that idea that the baby is prone, so chest to chest. So the parents, you know, have a naked chest, the baby is in a diaper, sometimes in a hat, and against chest to chest, using either a wrap or a blanket to hold them in place. Mm-hmm. The second component is the kangaroo nutrition, which would be providing breast milk as early as possible, so supporting the mom to start expressing milk and giving it, you know, in those countries by spoon or by dropper, here obviously by a tube or something, and then transitioning to breast milk. And then the third component really for those countries is really strict community follow-up. So those babies often go home much earlier than you would ever have in our country, because they're spending 24/7 in this kangaroo position on one of their family members. And then they would come back and forth to a clinic to have care, like getting their weight done and temperature done and things like that.
Wow. So is the project as it exists here, is that kangaroo project yours?
No. So it was, again, when it first came about, so when I think it was the end of 2017, the Ministry of Child and Family Development and Ministry of Health partnered with Perinatal Services, which is a department of PHSA, so the Provincial Health Authority. And they provided a one-time sort of grant to really strengthen this practice of kangaroo care. And a lot of the reason with that, they provided the grant, so yes, to PSBC, to the Women's Health Research Institute, the BC Women's Foundation, and BC Women's Hospital. And a lot of that came from a 20-year follow-up study. So there was a really important study that was done a few years ago by Natalie Tarpak and her team in Colombia, where they followed infants who were in kangaroo care in sort of the, I guess that would have been 90s, and they followed them 18 to 20 years later. So they found actually several hundred of the babies, which is quite a miracle to find people in that country, you know, that many years later. And they found them, and they still found improved outcomes. So they had a bunch of, you know, cognitive and behavioral outcomes that they were measuring, and they found improved outcomes in the babies that were randomized to the kangaroo mother care program versus the incubator care. And so anyways, that learning from that certainly is what has pushed, I think, MCFD to provide the money, and not only for, I guess, infant outcomes, but also the knowing that there's a lot of maternal improved outcomes with decreased depression and anxiety and things like that.
Is that typical of how a project like that kind of turns up at the PHSA to be studied and presented?
To be honest, I don't know. I don't think it's very typical to get such a large grant to be able to start a project like that.
Right.
But certainly the stars aligned and we were able to do that. And I think, you know, it's important. I think it's been highlighted more recently how much preterm birth affects, you know, outcomes into childhood and school age. And so, yeah, we were lucky enough to receive that.
Wow. Well, I can only imagine that all of the things that you felt you knew were tested and hopefully cemented when you had your own preterm infant in 2014. If you're willing, would you share some context on that? You know, how preterm was your child and did you need to stay in the NICU?
Yeah, certainly. My second baby, my daughter, was born at 31 weeks. So not, you know, not extremely preterm, but sort of in the middle range, and certainly needed an admission into the NICU for over about a month. You know, I think, yeah, I was obviously a true believer and passionate about it. I think what it really has allowed me to explore is just that idea that here I am as a nurse promoting it. And then now I have to actually do it. And that idea, you know, you're telling parents, you know, oh, it's great, you should do it and you can hold for a long time. But how do you logistically hold it? Which is probably, we'll talk about later, Alex will talk about the implementation is, you know, how do you tell a parent to sit there for 4 hours? And, you know, if they have, say, I had a toddler at home and, you know, my partner was at work. So how do you balance all of these things with the idea that you knew you should hold your baby for long periods, but also you also wanted to, you know, pay attention to your other child, or you wanted to pump your breast milk and all these things. So I think at least for me, it's allowed me to be more empathetic to other parents, obviously, and to be able to put myself in their shoes, and really advocate for supports for them, knowing that I also had a very unique, you know, circumstance. I worked in this unit. I knew the language, I knew the people, and it was still overwhelming for us. So I can't imagine putting myself, you know, in people's shoes who don't have that context, they have the unknown of what the NICU is.
Right. What was overwhelming about it all?
You know, I think I would say from the very first moment and from what I've learned, it's, for me, the most overwhelming thing was partly the birth situation of it happening unexpected. Having the baby, you know, I had a C-section, you're laying on the table and the baby is taken to another table and whisked away. So you have that separation already, which already happens, you know, in normal birth potentially, but having your baby removed from the room and not knowing, you know, despite the fact that I probably knew more than, again, I knew more than most parents, but not knowing what was happening. And I think that was probably one of the most overwhelming things, and then probably just the roller coaster of emotions that one day your baby can be great, and then you know, then you get the phone call of, oh, she has a fever, we're going to do a septic workup and see if she has an infection, and And again, I knew all the words and the lingo, and it was still overwhelming to me. So, I think you take on a little bit of the fear and the guilt of what's going to happen. So, yeah.
Were you able to engage in kangaroo care at the NICU that you and your baby were in? Was that easy to do?
Yeah, you know, so I was in two different NICUs. In the first NICU, for sure, it was quite easy to engage in, and people were very supportive. And you know, there were resources available, like chairs, for example, comfortable chairs to sit in, and I definitely could do it. I would say that you did get the odd, I think, belief or feeling that you should go home and rest, or you know. To leave. And I think for me, I hadn't realized how hard it would be to leave your baby. And at that time, BC Women's didn't have single room care. So you were all kind of in a open bay nursery. Mm-hmm. And so there was nowhere to sleep. So you would leave your baby at night. And I think you don't realize how difficult that is. Even if the baby is stable and doing really well, it's hard to leave your baby with other people. So yeah.
And you very recently had your fourth child. Congratulations.
Yes. Crazy or I don't know, but yes. Yeah. No. All happy and healthy for sure.
Well, we're definitely aware of how precious each of your moments are. So thank you for sharing some of them with us and with our listeners today.
Thanks.
We also have Alex Waldring here, the project coordinator for Kangaroo Care Perinatal Services BC. So Alex, your background is in sociology. And then from there, you headed into a master's in international development that you completed somewhere in 2016. So I have this image in my head. Here you are, and you're interested in the like social, cultural, political influences in things. And then you're studying and you're working in these international development projects, like toe-to-toe with the environmental scientists, the agricultural specialists, and the engineers. Tell me how that was.
Yeah, so I clearly come at this from a very different kind of background. But yeah, so I guess I was always kind of passionate about addressing inequality. That was really like the drive towards choosing my undergrad, which was in kind of sociology and political science. I grew up in Central and Southeast Asia, so I was kind of pretty acutely aware of like the global disparities in wealth and access to resources from the age of 8 or 9, really. So I think I was probably pretty shaped by my childhood and teenage years, and was really passionate about addressing inequality. So I did that for my undergrad. I didn't know where I wanted to take it at the time, but I think as it went on, I was like, oh, I'm really interested in looking at gender through a human rights-based approach. So I kind of got involved in, yeah, like I took classes to do with gender, and I was really passionate. I ended up then doing my master's in international development with focusing on gender. I did my dissertation was actually on natural resource management and like water management at the community level. So I looked at ways in which like women could be better integrated into control over natural resources, and then how that would change livelihoods in Nepal, which then led to my first job. I worked in a kind of private international development consulting firm that did international development work that was funded by multilateral and bilateral donors. It was focused on natural resource management and climate change mitigation and agriculture. That was an interesting experience. Somewhere in my master's year, in my final year, I did an internship at UNICEF in Sydney. And I went in thinking I'd always wanted to work in the kind of more male-dominated spaces, because I saw that there was so much space to move the needle in terms of gender equality there. But I did a kind of internship at UNICEF, and I was like, wow, I find pregnancy and childbirth and neonatal health really interesting. And from a kind of international development perspective, I was like, the disparities in maternal health outcomes across the world are huge. So I kind of had this seed planted that maybe I wanted to work in maternal health, and moved to Canada and somehow ended up here.
Well, I can imagine when you arrived at perinatal services, the kangaroo care program, like, just leaped out at you from the corner of the room saying, over here, help me over here.
Yeah, I actually, I watched Sarah do a presentation once and I knew nothing about kangaroo care. And I was like, wow, that is such an interesting concept, because in international development, the kind of flow of technology and technical expertise is kind of from the global north to the global south. So I'm saying all of this in inverted commas, but more developed countries to developing countries. That's a kind of traditional notion of like the flow of knowledge, technology, resources, and technical assistance. And then I saw, wow, like there's this practice that's happening in like the care of preterm infants. And it's such a low tech, natural, cost effective, highly evidence based practice that was developed in Colombia. And now we seem to be trying to move that practice to more developed countries like Canada. And it kind of goes against the whole traditional development paradigm. So I think it definitely stood out to me from a development studies perspective. And I was like, wow, that's incredibly interesting.
I've heard you say, if we go back to those international development projects, that they were often quite focused on, you know, trying to address gender inequality in the places that they would go in. But then sometimes that came down to like taking a woman's attendance at a meeting.
Yeah, it was, you know, kind of when you look at the social determinants of health and when you look at everything through a kind of sociological lens or a political science lens, you're taught to look at the kind of systemic ways in which inequality presents itself. You're taught to look at how like politics and economics and knowledge and power and the ways in which they kind of translate themselves create imbalances in control over resources and then inequality. And I thought in kind of environmental science and natural resources in that space, I felt that when addressing kind of gender inequality, it was more a case of what are the female stakeholders in this project? Can you come to the table? How many women did we have that attended this meeting? And then that was kind of reported on and sometimes never really followed up on. And it always kind of agitated me that we never took a deeper look into why in some circumstances women, you know, are really stuck in the domestic sphere, why they don't have control over natural resources and natural resource management, decision making, why there isn't even gender parity at these meetings. Like, what are the power dynamics that that could possibly like influence a woman's willingness to speak up and create space for like women's needs? So I was kind of, yeah, I guess agitated is a good word that it was.
I like that word. We can definitely land on that word.
Yep. That it was very much like you'd look at the final report and think, oh yeah, three women attended this meeting. So tick. And then
yes.
And then it never kind of pushed beyond that. So yeah, that was a frustration.
I was just going to say, when we consider kangaroo care, and I don't know, maybe Sarah wants to jump in here, but I'm guessing that the parents have feelings about using this as a method of care. Like, is it generally positive for the parents and involving these families in the care of their tiny, delicate infant?
I think starting out parents have told us that it's frightening, it's shocking. No parent kind of goes into like antenatal care and like preparing for birth expecting to end up in the NICU. And I mean, some infants have NICU stays for as long as 3 months and beyond. So yeah, it's the acceptability of the practice is definitely different in terms of the circumstances in the family. It's shocking for everyone, but families are also equipped differently to deal with those shocks and challenges. So part of kind of the kangaroo care model is putting in place these other supports to make sure that parents can be in the NICU 24/7 to hold their infant.
I was just going to say that this is, I mean, going back to those social determinants of health and those other sociological influences just on us, this now becomes way more than just the NICU. It's like, can parents have the time off to be in the NICU that much? And you're right, who cares for the other children? And
Yeah, it's like the NICU experience for families is like this tiny little microcosm of looking at people's lives more broadly. So many different considerations come up in terms of, can families be there to support their infant constantly? You know, the questions of like policy issues, like comprehensive paid maternity leave, parental leave, like can the father or partner be involved? Families that are traveling from outside of rural communities, like how do we support them to actually leave their communities and live in an urban center for an extended period of time? Childcare of, you know, siblings is also an issue. Yeah, how do parents navigate like rest and finding meals for themselves and just functioning in an environment that is completely new to them?
Okay, so we really would like to know about the evidence, and we understand that your project is about the barriers to implementation of such a program in a BC NICU. But it would be great to get a little bit of background on what we're actually talking about here. We've already talked a little bit about what kangaroo care is, but I'm curious, can you speak to some of the common things that keep babies in a NICU when they're preterm?
Yeah, so certainly, you know, the earlier a preterm baby is born, they often, which makes sense, have more complications because, you know, their development has been cut short, and so they have to sort of make up that time. And so certainly respiratory issues is a huge one. So the lungs haven't fully developed. Certainly there are interventions that we can do to help them, you know, having supporting breathing tubes and things like that. But yeah, so most infants that are smaller have respiratory issues. The next thing would be certainly feeding. So how do we get these babies to grow so that, you know, like you talked about in the beginning, everything happened in the mom's womb. And so now they're outside in this extrauterine environment. And how do we make it the same? So certainly they don't often feed by mouth right away. So they're either having, you know, food and nutrition through an IV into their vein. And then they're also having potentially a tube down their nose, a nasogastric tube that they would be provided, hopefully breast milk, or in all of our NICUs, we're super lucky to also have donor breast milk. So that would be what we would support, you know, families' choice to provide that. And so feeding is one of the, certainly a big milestone once you have, you know, respiratory issues have subsided and, you know, their lungs have grown and developed. One of the big milestones is certainly feeding on their own. So whether we're supporting mom to breastfeed or to eventually bottle feed, that is kind of the next milestone. And then it's the kind of growing, thermoregulating, so maintaining their temperature and then developing. So their brain, which is really the huge part that we speak to of with kangaroo care, is you have to really think of that baby coming out, whether it's, you know, 4 weeks early or 2 months early, they're missing out on that really vital brain development that would have happened in the mom's womb in that really special environment. And they're not prepared for the sensory circumstances of the NICU. So they're not prepared for the beeps and the noises and the light and, you know, the procedural touch and pain. And so it's trying to prevent any detrimental effects of that environment is super important for those preterm babies.
So is a preterm baby going to stay in a NICU or in the hospital until they sort of reach the stage that they would normally be as a full-term baby?
I mean, that's our goal. I think, you know, often, at least when I was working, you know, you'd have sort of as an end game goal would be, you know, let's hope that we can get your baby, you know, without having unrealistic expectations, but let's hope to get your baby home by time your, you know, your due date was. And whether that's a little bit earlier, a little bit later, but yeah, so that's kind of the goal for sure. Yeah.
And then the kangaroo care, I mean, that's not something that will actually help a baby's lungs make the surfactant that they need or improve their ability to swallow or suck, or can it?
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right in saying that it doesn't actually change their progression. There are certainly as you grow and just in your age, they'll attain some of those. Mm-hmm. But I think there has been enough research in knowing that, for example, because the parents are there, you know, as much as possible, they're watching their baby's cues. Often those babies feed earlier and they learn to breastfeed earlier because, again, just because the parent is attuned to their needs and they're able to, you know, observe their cues. And those parents often go home more confident because they have spent so much time with that baby. So mm-hmm. There are some studies, certainly Like you said, in our study, we didn't look at those outcomes, but internationally, there are studies that show that babies will achieve, you know, breastfeeding earlier if they're held in skin to skin for longer, and potentially some will go home earlier if they practice kangaroo care a lot.
That's fascinating.
Certainly in some settings, you know, in Scandinavia, they're a little more, I don't want to say advanced, but they've sort of taken on the model of kangaroo care really wholeheartedly. And then there they have studies that have show this sort of effectiveness of spending. They have units where parents do spend 24/7 in kangaroo care. They have parent beds beside the incubator, so the parent can actually lay in a bed with the baby strapped to them in the unit, which is very different from our setting. And in those settings, the babies are, you know, having improved outcomes for sure.
So baby health outcomes and maternal health outcomes are better when this model of care is used, which is, it's like, as Sue said, it's totally fascinating. If we consider it, it's actually just like, well, of course, if it's good for the baby, it's going to be good for the mommy. But it still makes me feel grateful and full of wonder about how biology works that way. But what I want to know is, how do they think it works? Why the chest to chest?
So, I mean, I think if you take it back even just to a term or, you know, a healthy baby, the goal is to put that baby skin to skin with the mom, because we know over evolution, there's biological sort of expectancies between the infant and the parent that they actually co-regulate each other. So it's a very similar response in why, you know, I think probably all maternity hospitals in BC right now is you do immediate skin-to-skin care after birth for, say, a term healthy baby not requiring resuscitation. Whereas in the NICU, we're separating babies because they need that resuscitation and that life-saving, you know, care, which is great, and we need to do that. But returning them back to the chest is the idea that we have sort of a set of nerves on our chest that are activated and that help release hormones in both the baby and the mom that provide sort of a calmness and provide physiological regulation and stability. So the heart rate stabilizes. We know that babies in skin-to-skin have more stable heart rates, more stable breathing rates. Sometimes their oxygen requirements decrease when they're in skin-to-skin. They thermoregulate. Certainly the really cool thing that I always like to bring up is, you know, there's studies where moms have held twins on their chest and one side of their chest has regulated to that baby specifically and the other chest has regulated to the other baby. It's fascinating. It's so amazing.
Totally fascinating. Just blows my mind.
Yeah. And the great thing about the mom, the unique thing about the mom's chest, I guess, and I don't want to leave out the partners, is the mom's chest can actually go up and down. So if the baby gets too hot, the mom will actually regulate down, whereas partner's chest will regulate up often, but they won't regulate down. So often we do get quite hot partners and then they're just not able to regulate down with the baby's temperature. So there's fascinating, amazing biological regulation between the babies and that's basically, yeah, how it works.
I love that. So to paraphrase, the regulation is about the nervous system, and we're calming and regulating the nervous system of the baby.
Yeah, I'd say the nervous system and how it, and with the mix of hormones and everything like that, it allows, yeah, some stability, physiological stability.
Totally fascinating.
One could tell instinctively that this is a good thing, but what are the health outcomes associated with this kind of nervous system and brain change?
They even actually, you already mentioned them, didn't you? You talked about like heart rates and oxygen rates and... So that's like an immediate response. But what about the later things?
Yeah, so it's a good point. I think, yeah, we talked about sort of that immediate response. I think the long-term outcomes certainly have looked more at cognitive and behavioral outcomes and whether into school age infants are able to regulate their emotions more. They've been able to have different outcomes in schooling. And so... when we're looking long-term, we look at more of the behavioral outcomes and the neurodevelopment of that baby.
It's like kangaroo care goes beyond just stabilizing the baby in the NICU and getting them from day to day, but what you're actually doing in the NICU influences a child all the way into like early adulthood and beyond. So it's more looking at like you're setting them up for a lifetime of mitigating the potential issues as a result of their preterm birth.
Wow. And what about mom? Are there any positive health outcomes for mom?
Yeah, so it's actually shown that kangaroo care helps reduce perinatal anxiety and depression as a result of like all that shock and stress. Parents can feel anxious about kind of the state of their infant as their condition can fluctuate in the NICU, and they can also become depressed. So kangaroo care can is a really effective like strategy at addressing that. Yeah.
And I understand that it improves the quality of sleep for the infant. Why is that so important for preterm infants?
So with preterm infants, as we talked about it before, of them being born, you know, early and missing out on that that time in the womb. So babies and preterm babies especially literally are building their brains when they're sleeping. And when you look at it, you know, we know that babies should be sleeping 20 plus hours a day, for example. And so we want to actually get those babies into a deep sleep. So in a really restorative, you know, REM sleep. And so what they've done in a lot of studies is they've looked at, well, let's measure, like, let's look at what sleep looks like in the incubator and then sleep looks like versus when a baby's held in kangaroo care. And when the baby's held in kangaroo care, they actually have longer sleep intervals. They go into a deeper sleep and they have just better sleep patterns. And it goes against, I think, the grain of what, certainly even what I was taught at 15 years ago, was that, you know, that the incubator was sort of the safe place, the place of care, I guess. And what we're trying to challenge is that idea that, you know, you may disturb the baby out of their sleep, but if a parent is there, that baby should be held in skin to skin in kangaroo care, because their sleep is more more effective and they go into a deeper restorative sleep. And so, again, using the parent's chest as the place of care is challenges our norms, in the sense that right now we have these fancy incubators and we're sort of, why would it sit there empty? But if we can have a parent doing the exact same thing, the outcomes will be hopefully better.
Right. I mean, it stands to reason that sleep in an incubator is an interrupted kind of sleep. Anyone who spent time in a hospital can tell you that sleep quality can be pretty poor. So with research showing that incubator sleep is a poor quality sleep than kangaroo care sleep, that's some more positive evidence.
Yeah, and I think I'd even add just really quickly is that from some of our interviews, we did have one provider who, for me, summed it up really well. And in the introduction, you talked a little bit about it, is that babies don't know stillness. And, you know, they've spent months and weeks in that mom's womb and moving with them, growing with them, smelling them, and all those things. And then they come out and we put them in a bed or a cot that's flat and doesn't move and doesn't smell and you know, it doesn't have a taste and all those things. Mm. So again, it that to me, when I interviewed that person, I went, oh my gosh, it just like, again, had another aha moment and was like, yes, we need to get these babies on these chests because they need to be back with, you know, feeling, smelling and all that stuff.
I love breaking that down, because you have that incubator and you're looking at the technology, and often the technology is king. Like, back to your point, Alex, about like this flows in a different direction. And there's such a wisdom to that. I'm just thrilled that there's evidence as well to support it. That's fantastic. Okay, so we are convinced. For the listeners, there'll be a link to a YouTube video called The Power of a Parent's Touch. That'll give you a sense of what this little kangaroo care might look like. There's a teeny tiny baby in the video. You'll watch it. You might be convinced as well. But tell us, you guys, about the NICUs in BC.
Yeah, so our implementation science project involved all 13 NICUs in BC. Our research, 11 of the NICUs opted in to be part of the research. So what we did was kind of took a baseline. So we went and visited 11 of the NICUs and talked to healthcare providers about what their barriers and enablers to kind of scaling up and, you know, maximizing the potential of kangaroo care in their setting were, with the goal of really making kangaroo care the standard of care in the NICU and really shifting the culture so that it's completely accepted that we would encourage parents to be there all the time and we would remove as many barriers as possible to a baby not being on a chest. Then Sarah kind of went back to all the NICUs, and we actually provided all the Ministry of Child and Family Development provided all preterm infants in the province with a kangaroo care wrap. So all families received a wrap to support kangaroo care practice. Sarah went back to all the NICUs and provided education to all of the staff and developed a UBC continuing professional development training program for healthcare providers in BC. And then finally we went back and after 6 months, kind of checked in with healthcare providers and parents about how they found the RAPs, how the education was supportive or wasn't, and what kind of practice changes they saw and then what they saw in terms of their what they needed to kind of continue to make the practice the standard of care. So we noticed that all NICUs are at very different stages in terms of realizing the full potential of kangaroo care. It comes down to kind of a few things. Firstly, kind of space and environmental resources. Some NICUs in BC, some of the tertiary centres are open bay NICUs, single room NICUs. So each family has a room to themselves. There's often a double bed where parents or other family members can sleep and sit reclined continuously to provide kangaroo care. They're provided with other supports like support for transport and hot meals and daycare and other kind of supports to keep them there, all the way to open bay NICUs, which have a reclining chair sometimes. Some NICUs actually don't have them, where the parent would sit next to the incubator for as long as they could, given the fact that they're in an open bay setting, you know, with potentially 20 other families right there with their infants as well. So the spatial barriers looked very different across the province. There was also kind of different beliefs in the practice. At the moment, there seems to be, you know, there's a lot of champions who are completely bought into the practice and sing its praises and have worked places that are really developmentally supportive and really far along this trajectory of providing kangaroo care, and they're completely bought in and really committed to addressing the barriers. And then there's others that kind of see it more as like a nice to do once the baby is stable. So there's a little bit of nervousness or healthcare providers feeling not confident just because it's not part of the NICU culture to be transferring babies onto parents and trying to keep them there. And yeah, just very different clinical practice. A lot of variation in clinical practice between healthcare providers. The NICUs look very different across the province.
And are these things that you've mentioned sort of the key barriers to adoption of the program, depending, of course, on the NICU, but like space or, you know, the health professional, thought, like commitment to the idea? Are those the chief things that you found as barriers, or were there others?
Yeah, I'd say they're the key barriers, but they're also the key enablers. So it's this kind of dual idea of, depending on the context that you're in, those factors can play as positives that really enable the practice and push it forward, or they can be the things that stand in the way and people struggle to kind of get past. They are barriers, but they are also enablers depending on which NICU you're standing in.
Interesting. Is there a dollar figure estimation on how, like, what is the economy of implementing a program like this? Maybe from like a cost perspective or cost benefit. Could this program save enough healthcare dollars in the long term that funds could be free to be allocated to different places?
You know, I think, you know, we obviously didn't do cost effectiveness for the project. Right. Certainly we know, and I believe I would say the things that you need most importantly, which we always say, is you need a comfortable chair, you need a wrap, and then in the NICU, often the baby's, you know, monitored. And I would say, so the biggest cost, if we were actually to say, you know, every preterm baby or every baby even who goes into the NICU, because sometimes they're not always preterm, they might be term and sick, say every baby, you know, got a wrap. So there would be that cost for sure. Mm-hmm. And that right now, yeah, previously it was under the kind of one-time grant that we received. So it's not an ongoing operational, most units don't have their operational budget to provide that. So we could definitely cost that out for how many, you know, how many preterm babies or term babies that go into the NICU per year. Mm-hmm. there's other studies in other countries that have looked at whether you would save money. And certainly, I mean, I think if we hypothesize that potentially babies are, you know, go home earlier, you're saving on, you know, we know how much it costs to stay in the NICU, and it's not, you know, it obviously is life-saving, but it does cost a lot. So if our families are going home earlier, and also I think the biggest thing, if parents are going home confident and they know their baby versus if they've spent, you know, those weeks, precious weeks and months together with their baby, they go home and we know there's often less readmissions, say, for example, into the ER. So that would, again, be another cost savings versus a parent who, say, you know, didn't spend a lot of time and then sort of a week before the baby had to go home, kind of came in and tried to get to know their baby. It doesn't always work out great. So sorry, I don't have we don't have a dollar amount for sure.
No, but I think you've given us an idea of the potential.
Yeah, and I think for the extension of the project and for the hope that, you know, this becomes more of a permanent fixture in the NICUs, certainly we're looking for ways to provide supports. And like Alex talked about, like, how can we make sure that families have hot meals? That's not a given. You know, it's not, you know, families aren't considered patients. It's the baby. So how do we support, how do we provide family-centered care, which is a really big component of our project, is how do we uplift those families, provide them accommodation, make them feel at home so that they can actually, you know, be the best parent they can be and be with that baby 24/7.
Yeah, kangaroo care is actually part of a much bigger shift in kind of neonatal culture towards family-centered care, which is the idea that the parents play an integral role as part of the baby's care team. They're there as much as possible. They engage in shared decision-making. They know their baby best and are best positioned to report on any changes in their condition. Yeah, just this idea of inclusivity of parents. It's a much broader kind of shift in the way that neonatal care is done. And it's a cultural shift that's ongoing in BC NICUs.
And I think you've spoken to it and you've said that, you know, depending on where you are, it's being received differently. But can you give us a sense of how well it's being received? This, let's change everything about how we approach neonatal care.
I think personally it was 100% positive, you know, and I think both healthcare provider and parents would say that they would want to do it. And I think, like we talked about, there's a lot of underlying barriers, whether it's the cultural context of it, where it's, you know, or it's environment, where providers are feeling like they can't quite do that. So, or parents can't. So, you know, for example, if there's only one reclining chair in a unit that has six beds, then the parents arrive and they have to wait for the chair to come, you know? And so I think there is a wholeheartedly 100% people are in and want to do it. But I think there is a bit of that, well, how, like, show me how I'm going to do it. And how are you going to support us? And I think a bit of the feeling of, you know, because it doesn't happen in any of the units to the full extent, people do want it to be proven, you know, and they want to know, well, how am I going to do it? And we know units in Sweden do it, but we're not Sweden. So there's that idea a little bit of that. I think they want us, or at least I guess maybe it's me. I want to prove to them that they can do it. But I do understand that, you know, it's really difficult as a healthcare provider to provide intensive acute care to a tiny baby and then to support a family emotionally and then to get them, you know, set up in a chair and sitting there and all those things. So it's like we talked about, yeah, there's a lot of barriers to certainly overcome, but I think everyone is on board. It's just how to overcome them.
So I understand that you have a paper coming out in early 2021 that documents the findings in this study. Can you tell us a little bit about what it's called and where people can find it if they're interested in learning more?
Yeah, so it's called An Implementation Science Study of Kangaroo Care in BC NICUs, and it'll be available through Biomed Central, so that's BMC Pregnancy and Childbirth, so that's an open access peer-reviewed journal. So if you'll be able to access it through BMC if you're interested, or it'll also be on the Perinatal BC website under Kangaroo Care.
Great. And what's the vision for the project? It seems like you're trying to convince a funding body that this is the way that administration of care for preterm infants should go in BC. Listeners might be thinking, this seems so simple and so right. Why wouldn't we not just pivot in this direction? What's your picture for the future?
You know, I think for me, it does go back to the family-centered care, and it goes back to really ensuring that kangaroo care is a model of care, is what we, the kind of the lingo, I guess we would say. Mm-hmm. And that idea that all NICUs would have the same experience, because I think we touched on briefly, but, you know, parents often move between NICUs. A lot of parents have the experience of starting in one NICU and moving to another, and care or resources are different. So really making sure there's an equitable practice across the province, really supporting healthcare providers to believe that the place of care could be the parent, and that high technology is great. And of course we need it, and we're so lucky that we have it. But I think it's almost like peeling back and going a little bit backwards and saying, you know, how can we use the parent to improve outcomes? So back to you. I think it's hoping that all the NICUs have the same care and ensuring that, you know, we have better outcomes for all the infants, for sure. And how I touched on, I think we probably, and as a clinician, I never thought I'd say this, but I think we need a lot more research. It's certainly something I've become obviously randomly passionate about, is that research is really important. And hopefully, I'm hoping Alex will jump on board and remain my research partner, and we'll do more and really try to prove to people that we can do it in our setting.
So I have a question, because it never even crossed my mind. Why would you have to move from one NICU to another? I don't understand that.
People have to move for higher acuity of care. Unfortunately, the way, you know, the province where the population is, the density, so we have our level 3 nurseries, which provide the highest level of care, are in either the lower mainland or they're on the island. So, and different specialties are in different hospitals. So you often have to move, for those reasons. And then you would move back once your baby is stable, you'd move back to your home NICU and be closer to home.
Okay. And do you see that this is something we could do relatively soon, moving to a more kangaroo care type model, or are we years away from that?
I'd like to say we're doing it next week.
right now.
But I think it, like, when you're looking for funding to kind of continue things, it is really kind of a pivot and see where the opportunities are as you go. We also kind of have a bit of a dream to support parents through some knowledge translation materials. One of the questions that we asked healthcare providers all across the province was, if a parent asked to do kangaroo care, would you support it? And every single time we asked them, they were like, absolutely, we would never not support a parent to do kangaroo care. So we had this kind of idea of, you know, help me hold. If we could support parents to actually request kangaroo care, then combined with our healthcare provider side interventions, could that actually be a really successful model if we tackle it from both sides? So that's a little kind of knowledge translation project that we're hoping can come to fruition. But yeah, the timeline is somewhat uncertain, but yeah, we'll just keep pushing.
And what do you see, both of you, as the best possible outcome of the project?
Oh, continuous kangaroo care in all NICUs.
So that universal experience that you were talking about, is that part of the kangaroo care in all environments? Like that every NICU would do it, no matter where they went, there would be the language around it and then the setup around it.
Yeah, I think I would, and I'd go a step further. I'd like to say that it's in the NICU and it's planting a seed in the community. So it's doing this podcast. It's talking to a grandma who happens to have a granddaughter who has a preterm baby. You know, it's how do we make skin-to-skin and kangaroo care a norm? Because I think once it's a norm in society that you're holding your baby's lots in the hospital, it creeps into conversations. That I'm always surprised when people are like, oh, I saw that on Grey's Anatomy. Or, you know, whatever it is, I think that's what we want. We want this mainstream, right? And I think even I'd go one step further, even what Alex is saying, like going into communities that potentially don't have it now. So I know certainly we'd love it. You know, we've talked a little bit about doing kangaroo care with babies that might be experiencing withdrawal and going into units like that. Or so there's many other ways that I think we can also use skin to skin as a super powerful tool for babies' health outcomes.
Right.
So I just had a thought about that. Can I just jump in here?
Yeah.
What about the senior volunteers that are baby holders?
I mean there's many hospitals that have volunteers that do cuddling. Obviously this is pre-COVID, unfortunately, but you know, they're doing cuddling. So certainly the baby is either wrapped in a blanket or and they're not doing skin to skin, which I would still say, you know, all human touch is important. So I don't want that baby sitting in a cot just because they can't be held kangaroo care, you know. So certainly they still benefit from having that human contact, making eye contact and, you know, hearing, you know, a nursery rhyme or whatever it is that that cuddler is doing. So very important for sure. If the parent can't be there, we want to, yeah, we want to have volunteers or healthcare providers hold those babies and allow them to have that that human contact.
Where do you think it might roll out first? Is it something that sort of happens in an urban center first and moves out to rural areas, or how do you see it rolling out across the province?
Oh, this is interesting because based on our kind of baseline findings, I think the rollout is going to look so different depending on the site, just because everyone is either further down this family-centered care journey, mm-hmm. or they are experiencing very different spatial constraints and like physical resource constraints. I'd say it would probably, like, it is already kind of beginning to roll out in the BC Women's single family room NICU, but also to the credit of like much smaller sites who also have like these really passionate people who are pushing it forward in open bay NICUs. So I'm not sure it's a matter of a NICU will go first and then there'll be this really structured rollout. It's just going to be a matter of like supporting each site at the same time to reach certain implementation goals. And it's going to look very different.
I have one last thought. And, you know, we're talking about this comfortable reclining chair. And I, because of what I do as a pelvic health therapist, I see a whole lot of moms postpartum. And, you know, that mom is my focus. I keep her going so that she can do the baby care and keep the baby and the family going. And that, that comfy chair is really important because that mom just had a baby. We got to give her a comfy place to be. So that was my PSA. So we're down to our final question, and then we ask everybody that comes to the show. So we want to know from each of you, what is health? How about you go first, Alex?
Oh my gosh, what a loaded question. I tend to think of health as something that's quite systemic and exists at kind of the community level before it exists at the individual level. So I think kind of communities having, you know, access to fresh food, clean water, non-polluted soil, space to move around, community cohesion, a kind of collective sense of values, connection, which we're finding is a really big struggle given the pandemic circumstances that we're all in. But I think it really is just about healthy communities. Healthy communities influence the healthy individual. And if you have all these kind of supportive factors in place, then that kind of supports the individual to thrive.
I love that. You find it in the community first and then the individual. And I would challenge people. I bet you most people think about it in themselves first. So I like that. And to take us home, what about you, Sarah? What is health to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I did. I probably took it more as the individualistic kind of point of view and my personal, I guess, views on it. And I guess for myself, it's about achieving some sort of equilibrium in your life, whether it's your, you know, mind, body, kind of spirit idea. And for me, it's finding that one thing that you love or that one thing that fills your bucket. At least for me, you know, my equilibrium gets out of sorts if I don't move my body every day. And so if it's, it may not be movement for you or someone else. It may be, you know, making sourdough bread or you know, playing the violin. But whatever it is, you know, do it often and do it as much as you can, because certainly for my mental health is much better when my physical health is in check. And then I would kind of reflect on Alex's piece and say, find that community that supports you and has similar values, whether it's your partner or friends or, you know, another group, because there's going to be times when you need them to rise up and to support you when you can't get to that equilibrium. And so just really, yeah, find those supports and those people that will help you.
We want to say thank you so much for both of you for spending your time here with us today and letting us know about your Kangaroo Care project. I think it's really exciting and I really hope the best for it.
Oh, thank you so much to you both. And you're both doing wonderful work shedding light on all these different kind of public health topics. I've loved listening to all of them and I've learned so much from it. So well done to you.
Well, thank you both so much for your work on behalf of preterm infants and their families here in BC. Jillian and I are really excited to see what happens next with this project. Low tech, low cost, widely accessible intervention has so much potential to change the outcomes for these vulnerable humans and their parents, and to save healthcare dollars too. And that's got to be a win for everyone, doesn't it? That's all for today's small conversation. We'll be here next time.
And we'll have the coffee on.
If you liked what you heard, we encourage you to head on over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review. Better yet, subscribe and leave a review. That really helps to make it easier for others to find us, to help broaden this small conversation.